Side 11, Atreides on White Magic, continuing Rule 11, page 471.
There is no need for me to add to the vast amount of literature which has been put forth, or to emphasize the significance of purpose in connection with such a thought form as a solar system, a planet, a kingdom in nature, or a human being. In some respects, this subjective triplicity of purpose, activity, and goal is well known, and in others it is of too high and too inscrutable a nature for us to deal with in these instructions and wander into the realms of speculation. With the goal, religion has long sought to deal. With the activity aspect, the scientist is now attempting to deal. And with the will of God, the most advanced thinkers and philosophers are constantly speculating. Only when man submits himself to the discipline of his own spiritual will and controls the activity of the lives within his form nature, and so orients himself to the goal as it progressively makes its appeal to his vision, will he arrive at a true understanding of the plan, which constitutes the will of God as far as human beings can grasp it. But with the thought forms which he is beginning to create as he daily learns to think, we can concern ourselves, for it is the first lesson soon to be learnt in the magical work. The creator in mental matter has, A, to learn to build intelligently, B, to give the impulse through right speech which will animate that which he has built, and so enable the thought form to convey the intended idea. C, to send out his thought form correctly oriented to his goal, and so truly directed that it will reach the objective and accomplish its sender's purpose. The necessity for clear thinking and the elimination of idle, destructive, and negative thoughts becomes increasingly apparent as the aspirant progresses upon his way. As the power of the mind increases, and as the human being differentiates his thought increasingly from mass thought, he inevitably builds thought substance into form. It is at first automatic and unconscious. He cannot help so doing, and fortunately for the race, the forms constructed are so feeble that they are largely innocuous, or so in line with mass thought that they are negligible in their effect. But as man evolves, his power and his capacity to harm or to help increases, and unless he learns to build rightly and correctly to motivate that which he has built, he will become a destructive agency and a center of harmful force, destroying and harming not only himself, as we shall see shortly, but equally hurting and harming those who vibrate to his note. Granted all this, you might appositely inquire, are there some simple rules which the earnest and sincere beginner could apply to this science of building, and which are so clear and concise that they will produce the needed effect? There are, and I will state them simply so that the beginner will, if he follows them, escape the dangers of black magic and learn to build in line with the plan. He will, if he follows the rules I give, avoid the intricate problem which he has himself blindly constructed, and which will indeed shut out the light of day, darken his world, and imprison him in a wall of forms which will embody for him his own peculiar great illusion. These rules may sound too simple for the learned aspirant, but for those who are willing to become as little children, they will be found to be a safe guide into truth and will eventually make them able to pass the tests for adeptship. Some are couched in terms symbolic, others are necessarily blinds, still others express the truth just as it is. 1. View the world of thought and separate the false out of the true. 2. Learn the meaning of illusion and in its midst locate the golden thread of truth. 3. Control the body of emotion, for the waves that rise upon the stormy seas of life engulf the swimmer, shut out the sun, and render all plans futile. 4. Discover that thou hast a mind and learn its dual use. 5. Concentrate the thinking principle and be the master of thy mental world. 6. Learn that the thinker and his thought, and that which is the means of thought, are diverse in their nature, yet one in ultimate reality. 7. Act as the thinker, and learn it is not right to prostitute thy thought to the base use of separative desire. 8. The energy of thought is for the good of all, and for the furtherance of the plan of God. Use it not, therefore, for thy selfish ends. 9. Before a thought form is by thee constructed, vision its purpose, ascertain its goal, and verify the motive. 10. For thee, the aspirant on the way of life, the way of conscious building is not yet the goal. The work of cleaning out the atmosphere of thought, of barring fast the doors of thought to hate and pain, to fear and jealousy and low desire, must first precede the conscious work of building. See to thy aura, O traveler on the way. 11. Watch close the gates of thought. Sentinel desire. Cast out all fear, all hate, all greed. Look out and up. 12. Because thy life is mostly centered on the plane of concrete life, thy words and speech will indicate thy thought. To these pay close attention. 13. Speech is of triple kind. The idle words will each produce effect. If good and kind, naught need be done. If otherwise, the paying of the price cannot be long delayed. The selfish words, sent forth with strong intent, build up a wall of separation. Long time it takes to break that wall and so release the stored up selfish purpose. See to thy motive and seek to use those words which blend thy little life with the large purpose of the will of God. The word of hate, the cruel speech which ruins those who feel its spell, the poisonous gossip passed along because it gives a thrill, these words kill the flickering impulses of the soul, cut at the roots of life, and so bring death. If spoken in the light of day, just retribution will they bring. When spoken and then registered as lies, they strengthen that illusory world in which the speaker lives and holds him back from liberation. If uttered with intent to hurt, to bruise and kill, they wander back to him who sent them forth, and him they bruise and kill. 14. The idle thought, the selfish thought, the cruel, hateful thought, if rendered into word, produce a prison, poison all the springs of life, lead to disease, and cause disaster and delay. Therefore be sweet and kind and good as far as in thee lies. Keep silence, and the light will enter in. 15. Speak not of self. Pity not thy fate. The thoughts of self and of thy lower destiny prevent the inner voice of thine own soul from striking upon thine ear. Speak of the soul, enlarge upon the plan, forget thyself in building for the world. Thus is the law of form offset. Thus can the rule of love enter upon that world. These simple rules will lay right foundations for the carrying forward of the magical work and will render the mental body so clear and so powerful that right motive will control and true work in building will be possible. Much of the significance of this rule must remain theoretical and be considered as holding a challenge until such time as the real magical work of thought form building becomes universally possible. The formula, as we have seen, will remain unknown to all save the members of the hierarchy of adepts for long ages to come. The directional words are capable of ascertainment, but only to those who are working consciously under the guidance of their own souls and who, through mind control, merging into deep meditation, can manipulate the matter of thought and become knowing creators. These can and do speak the impulsive words which bring into being those new forms and organisms, those expressions of ideas, and those organizations which live their life cycle and serve their purpose, and so come duly to their timely and appointed end. These creators are the leaders and organizers, the teachers and the guides in all phases of human living. Their sound does go forth into all lands, and their note is internationally recognized. Hundreds of such names are easily remembered and spring unbidden to the mind. They live in the memory of the multitude, and that which lives is the sound of their accomplishment, be that good or bad. But in the sentence which we must consider, we find portrayed a universal function, even though it is as yet carried forward for the most part unconsciously. The words to be dealt with are as follows. 3. Finally, to utter forth the mystic phrase which will save him from their work. Therefore, it appears that at the close of the magical work of creation, a phrase must be enunciated which effects a salvation and produces a liberation of a dual kind, a liberation of the creating agent from the form which he has created, and the emancipation of that form from the control of the one who has brought it into being. It is obvious that already the nature of speech is in relation to embodied ideas is being somewhat understood. Study the method of talk, which is now the main factor employed to launch an idea. Note how all inventions, which are neither more nor less than embodied concepts, come into exoteric being on the physical plane through the power of the spoken word, and consider also with care the occult significance underlying all conferences, all meetings, all consultations, and all discussions which concern themselves with the launching of some idea or set of ideas upon the sea of public necessity. May it not be possible that under the modes of activity employed by the advertising agencies and the constant training given to salesmen in the use of the spoken word as a means of approach to the public in order to sell an idea, we shall find the first distorted indications of the emanations of those mystic phrases which will bring into being the creation of the soul in all fields of creative enterprise? The training of public opinion, the utilization of catchwords and slogans, the tendency to embody the concepts of campaigners in trite and apposite phrases are part of the growing realization as to the magical work. All these means are employed blindly and without true realization. They constitute a part of the emerging activities of a humanity which is on the verge of real creative work, the principles of which are not yet understood nor scientifically applied. But they do point the way, and under the simplification which marks the return to synthesis, we shall have the cessation of speech and the utilization of simpler forms. Under the evolutionary urge, we have had the creative sound, the word, speech. The latter, in its turn, has been differentiated into words, phrases, sentences, paragraphs, books, until we now have the era wherein this differentiation is at its height, and we have speeches at all hours of the day and night. We have the utilization of the public platform to reach the public ear, and of the radio to reach all classes and races of humanity in an effort to mold public opinion and bring certain ideas and concepts into the public consciousness. We have the publication of books literally in their millions, and all playing their part in the same great work, and we have as yet both methods of communication being prostituted to the selfish ends and ambitious purposes of those who speak and write. Yet there are a few true creators who are endeavoring to make their sound heard, to speak those mystical words which will enable humanity to see the vision. Thus will be dispersed eventually the clouds of thought forms which at this time shut out the clear light of God. The subject is too large for me to elaborate in this treatise. I but seek to make suggestions which will carry to the intelligent reader some idea of the enormous progress which has been made in the magical work. In this way, he will be enabled to go forward with optimism, knowing that hitherto all has been good inasmuch as man has progressed in knowledge. Out of the present welter of speech and of words, of lectures and of books, a few clear concepts will surely emerge which will find an echo in the hearts of men. Thus also will men be led on into the new age, wherein talk will die out and books come to naught, for the lines of subjective communication will lie open. Men will recognize that noise acts as a deterrent to telepathic intercourse. The written word will not be needed either, for men will use symbols of light and color to supplement through the eye what the subjective hearing has recorded. But that day is not yet, even though the radio and television are the first steps in the right direction. Putting the truth as simply as possible, we might state that through the complexity of much speech-making and book-writing, ideas are now enabled to take form and so run through their cycle of activity. But this method is as unsatisfactory in the field of knowledge as is the ancient tallow dip in the field of illumination. Electric light has superseded it, and someday the true telepathic communication and vision will take the place of speech and of writings. Carrying the same concepts into the field of real esoteric work, we have the worker in thought matter building his thought form and confining the lives which express and respond to his idea within a ring pass knot. This latter persists for as long as his mind attention and hence his ensouling energy is directed upon it. We have him pronouncing the words which will enable his thought form to do its work, fulfill the mission for which it has been constructed, and carry out the purpose for which it was created. All that has been given out hitherto in connection with the words used in the creative work is the sevenfold sacred word Aum. This, when rightly used by the soul on the mental plane, vitalizes and expedites all thought forms, and so produces successful enterprise. It is interesting to note that in Atlantean days, the word used was Tau, enunciated explosively and so forcefully that the thought forms thus energized and expedited acted inevitably like a boomerang and returned to the one who sent them forth. This word Tau is likewise, in its symbolic form, the symbol of reincarnation. It is desire for form which produces the use of form and causes cyclic and constant rebirth in form. It was the constant use of the Tau, likewise, which brought about the final overwhelming with water which swept away the ancient Atlantean civilization. The few who used the Aum in those days were not potent enough to offset the force of desire. The mind bodies of the race could not respond to that newer creative sound. Humanity was still swept entirely by longing and desire to such an extent that the united desire for possessions and for the enjoyment of form drove men esoterically into the waters. Desire for form still forces upon humanity the constant process of rebirth until such time as the Tao influence is exhausted and the Aum sound can dominate. The former influence is, however, weakening, and the Aum is increasing in potency until it will be the dominating factor. To this latter sound, the word of the soul must eventually succeed, until Aum, in its turn, is entirely superseded. The sound of many waters, which is the symbolic way of expressing the Tao influence, will cease, and the time will come, as we are assured in the Christian Bible, when there will be no more sea. Then the sound of the Aum, which is symbolically spoken of as the roaring of a blazing fire, and which is the sound of the mental plane, will take its place. The word of the soul cannot be given except in the secret place of initiation. It has its own peculiar vibration and note, but this cannot be conveyed until such time as the Aum is used with correctness. Just as the Tao, carrying the note of desire and of the urge to have and to be, was misused and carried its civilizations to disaster, so Aum can also be misused and can carry its civilizations into the fire. This is the truth which rarely underlies the misunderstood Christian teaching anent hell fire and the lake of fire. They portray symbolically the end of the age when the mental plane civilizations will come to a cataclysmic end as far as the form aspect is concerned, just as the earlier civilizations came to a watery consummation. One hint here I will give, and one that is oft overlooked. On the mental plane, time is not. Therefore, the time equation enters not into the idea of a final ending by fire. There is no setting of a time for a disaster or a catastrophe. The full effect will take place in the realm of the mind, and may it not be said that even now the fire of anxiety, of foreboding, of worry, and of fear is burning up our thoughts and engrossing our mental attention? Its work is to purify and cleanse, so let the Aum do its work, and let all of you who can employ it with frequency and with right thought, so that the world purification may proceed apace. Much must be burned and consumed, which bars the way for the emergence of the new ideas, the new archetypal forms. These will eventually dominate the new age and make it possible for the word of the soul to sound forth and be heard exoterically. I realize that that which I have imparted here is difficult of comprehension, but the paragraphs above dictated hold warning for the careless and much instruction for the earnest seeker after light. There are two aspects of this phrase which we are considering, with which I seek briefly to deal. There are many which I might take up, but two will suffice to carry practical suggestion and to indicate ideas which aspirants everywhere would do well to grasp. The thought of salvation from the effect of form-embodied ideas must be considered, and I would like also to cover the idea of a saving from under two headings. The aspirant has to be saved from the thought forms built daily during his mental life, and a soul in incarnation has also to be saved from the form attachments which during the ages have grown and strengthened, and from which he has to be released through the process we call death. We will therefore divide our subject as follows. 1. Salvation from the power exerted by the thought forms we have ourselves created. 2. Salvation from the power of the threefold body which the soul has built through the magical release called death. It is with the latter that I wish primarily to deal, but certain things must be said concerning the power of thought forms and concerning their danger and the mode whereby they can be rendered innocuous. Salvation from our thought forms. I speak now for aspirants who, through concentration and meditation, are gaining power in thought. I speak for the thinkers of the world, who, through their one-pointed application and devotion to business, to science, to religion, or to the varying modes of human activity, have oriented the mind, not the emotions, but the mentality, to some line of constant action which is necessarily a part of the divine activity in the large sense. It is right here, in the use of thought, that the difference between black and white magic can be seen. Selfishness, ruthlessness, hatred, and cruelty characterize the worker in mental substance whose motives are, for many lives, centered around his own aggrandizement, focused on his personal acquisition of possessions, and directed entirely to the attainment of his own pleasure and satisfaction, no matter what the cost to others. Such men are, happily, few, but the way to such a point of view is easy to achieve, and many need to guard themselves lest they tread unthinkingly the way towards materiality. A gradual and steady growth in group consciousness and responsibility, a submergence of the wishes of the personal self, and the manifestation of a loving spirit characterize those who are oriented towards the life side of the divine whole. It might be said that human beings fall into three main groups. 1. The vast majority, who are neither good nor bad, but simply unthinking and entirely submerged in the evolutionary tide and in the work of developing a true self-consciousness and the needed equipment. 2. A very small number, who are definitely and consciously working on the side of materiality, or, if you prefer so to express it, on the side of evil. Potent are they on the physical plane, but their power is temporal and not eternal. The law of the universe, which is the law of love, is eternally against them, and out of the seeming evil, good will come. 3. A goodly number who are the pioneers into the kingdom of the soul, who are the exponents of the New Age ideas and the custodians of that aspect of the ageless wisdom which is next to be revealed to mankind. This group is constituted of the unselfish and intelligent men and women in every field of human endeavor, of the aspirants and disciples, of the initiates who sound the note for the various groups and types, and of the occult hierarchy itself. The influence of this band of mystics and knowers is exceedingly great, and the opportunity to work in cooperation with it at this time is easier of attainment than at any other time in racial history. The first group is unthinking. The two other groups are beginning to think and to employ the laws of thought. It is with the use of thought by the aspirant that I seek to deal. Much about thought will be found in A Treatise on Cosmic Fire, but I intend to give some practical ideas and suggestions which will help the average aspirant to work as he should. Let us remember, first of all, that no aspirant, no matter how sincere and devoted, is free from faults. Were he free, he would be an adept. All aspirants are still selfish, still prone to temper and to irritability, still subject to depression and even at times to hatred. Oft that temper and hatred may be aroused by what we call just causes. Injustice on the part of others, cruelty to human beings and to animals, and the hatreds and viciousness of their fellow men do arouse in them corresponding reactions and cause them much suffering and delay. One thing must ever be remembered. If an aspirant evokes hatred in an associate, if he arouses him to temper, and if he meets with dislike and antagonism, it is because he himself is not entirely harmless. There are still in him the seeds of trouble, for it is a law in nature that we get what we give, and produce reactions in line with our activity, be it physical, emotional, or mental. There are certain types of men who do not come under this category. When a man has reached a stage of high initiation, the case is different. The seed ideas he seeks to convey, the work he is empowered to do, the pioneering enterprise he is endeavoring to carry forward, may, and often do, call forth from those who sense not the beauty of his cause and the rightness of the truth he enunciates, a hatred and a fury which causes him much trouble and for which he is not personally responsible. This antagonism comes from the reactionaries and the devotees of the race, and it should be remembered that it is largely impersonal, even though focused on him as the representative of an idea. But with these high souls I deal not, but with students of the ageless wisdom who are learning not only that they seldom think, but that when they do, they are oft thinking wrongly. For they are forced into a thought activity by reactions which have their seat in their lower nature and are based on selfishness and lack of love. There are three lessons which every aspirant needs to learn. First, that every thought form which he builds is built under the impulse of some emotion or of some desire. In rarer cases, it may be built in the light of illumination and embody, therefore, some intuition. But with the majority, the motivating impulse which sweeps the mind stuff into activity is an emotional one, or a potent desire, either good or bad, either selfish or unselfish. Secondly, it should be borne in mind that the thought form so constructed will either remain in his own aura or will find its way to a sensed objective. In the first case, it will form part of a dense wall of such thought forms which entirely surround him or constitute his mental aura, and will grow in strength as he pays it attention until it is so large that it will shut out reality from him, or it will be so dynamic and potent that he will become the victim of that which he built. The thought form will be more powerful than its creator, so that he becomes obsessed by his own ideas and driven by his own creation. In the second case, his thought form will find its way into the mental aura of another human being or into some group. You have here the seeds of evil, magical work, and the imposition of a powerful mind upon a weaker. If it finds its way into some group, analogous impulsive forms found within the group aura will coalesce with it, having the same vibratory rate or measure. Then the same thing will take place in the group aura as has taken place within the individual ring pass knot. The group will have around it an inhibiting wall of thought forms, or it will be obsessed by some idea. Here we have the clue to all sectarianism, to all fanaticism, and to some forms of insanity, both group and individual. Thirdly, the creator of the thought form, in this case an aspirant, remains responsible. The form remains linked to him by his living purpose, and therefore the karma of the results and the ultimate work of destroying that which he has built must be his. This is true of every embodied idea, the good as well as the bad. The creator of them all is responsible for the work of his creation. The Master Jesus, for instance, has still to deal with the thought forms which we call the Christian Church, and has much to do. The Christ and the Buddha have still some consummating work to carry through, though not so much with the forms which embody their enunciated principles, as with the souls who have evolved through the application of those principles. With the aspirant, however, who is still learning to think, the problem is different. He is still prone to use thought matter to embody his mistaken apprehension of the real ideas. He is still apt to express his likes and dislikes through the power of thought. He is still inclined to use the mind stuff to make possible his personality desires. To this, every sincere aspirant will bear witness. Much concern is being felt among many of you as to the guarding of thoughts and the protection of formulated ideas. Some thoughts are ideas clothed in mental matter and keep their habitat on the plane of thought matter. Such are the abstract conceptions and the scarcely sensed facts of the inner occult or mystic life that pass through the mind of the thinker. They are not so difficult to guard, for their vibrations are so high and light that few people have the power to clothe them adequately in mental matter, and those few are so very scarce that the risk of such statements being unwisely promulgated is not very great. Then there are the communications involved in occult teaching. The circle of those who apprehend them is widening somewhat, and these thought forms frequently take to themselves astral matter from the desire in the heart of the student to verify, corroborate, and share with the group whose knowledge is as vital as his. Sometimes this is possible and sometimes not. If prohibited, what is the method of protection then? Largely a refusing to allow the matter of the astral plane to adhere to the mental thought form. Fight the matter out on the desire level and inhibit that type of matter from formulating. Where no desire to speak exists, and where the striving is to prevent the gathering of the material around the nucleus, another thought form is built up, one that intervenes and protects. Still another type of thought form comes forth, the most prevalent and the one that causes the most trouble. These are the facts of information, the detailed material, the news, if so you like to call it, the basis of what may degenerate into gossip, that concerns either your work, administrative or otherwise, and that which concerns other people. How shall you prevent your mind from transmitting to another facts such as these? These are facts that have their origination in physical plane occurrence, and therein lies the difficulty. The inner facts of the occult life and those that originate on the mental plane are not so difficult to hide. They do not come your way till your vibrations are keyed high enough for them, and as a rule, when that is so, character of sufficient stability and wisdom goes alongside. But it is not thus with the physical plane fact. What must be done? The other thoughts descend from above. These latter work upwards from the physical plane and are increased in vitality by the knowledge of the many, often of the many unwise. One kind starts nebulously on the mental plane, and only the higher type of mind can formulate it and clothe it with matter in geometrical precision, and such a mind usually has the wisdom that refuses to clothe it in astral plane matter. Not so with the physical plane fact. It is a vital entity, robed in material of the astral plane and the mental plane when first you meet and contact it. Will you vitalize it or will you arrest it? Arrest it by a rush and wave of love for the party implicated that envelops the thought form and sends it back to the originator, born on the wings of a surge of astral plane matter, strong enough to sweep through and around, mayhap disintegrating, but most certainly returning it harmlessly to the sender. Perhaps it is an evil piece of information, a lie or item of gossip. Devitalize it by love. Break it in pieces by the power of a counter-thought form of peace and harmony. Or again, it may be true, some sad or evil occurrence or deed of some mistaken brother. What then is there to do? Truth cannot be devitalized or disintegrated. The law of absorption will aid you here. Into your heart you absorb the thought form you encounter and there transmute it by the alchemy of love. Let me be practical and illustrate, for the matter is of importance. Some brother comes to you and tells to you a fact about another brother, a fact involving what the world would call wrongdoing on that brother's part. You who know so much more than the average man of the street will realize that that so-called wrongdoing may be but the working out of karma, or have its basis in a good motive, wrongly construed. You add naught to the talk. You do not hand on the information. As far as you are concerned, the thought form, built around the fact, has wandered into what you call a cul-de-sac. What do you do then? You build a counter-stream of thoughts, which, on a wave of love, you send your apparently erring brother, thoughts of kindly assistance, of courage and aspiration, and of a wise application of the lessons to be learnt from the deed he has accomplished. Use not force, for strong thinkers must not unduly influence other minds, but a gentle stream of wise transmuting love. We have here three methods, none strictly occult, for those later shall be imparted, but methods available for the many. First, the thought form kept to the mental levels, i.e., the inhibiting of astral plane matter. Second, the thought form broken up and disintegrated by a stream of love force well directed. Third, the absorbing of the thought form and the formulation of a counter-thought of loving wisdom. Inhibition, disintegration, absorption. There are three main penalties which attach to the wrong use of thought substance, and from these the aspirant must learn to save himself and to avoid those activities. Eventually, this will make the process of salvation unnecessary. 1. A potent thought form can act like a boomerang. It can return, charged with increased velocity, to the one who sent it on its mission. A strong hatred, clothed in mental matter, can return to its creator, charged with the energy of the hated person, and can hence work havoc in the life of the aspirant. Hate not, for hatred returns ever from whence it came. There is a depth of truth in the ancient aphorism, "Curses like chickens come home to roost." A potent desire for material acquisition will eventually return, bringing inevitably that which has been desired, only to find in the majority of cases that the aspirant no longer aches for possession, but regards it as an incubus, or, in the meantime, already possesses more than he needs and is satiated and knows not what to do with all that he has gained. A potent thought form embodying an aspiration for spiritual illumination or for recognition by the master may bring such a flood of light as to blind the aspirant and make him consequently the possessor of a wealth of spiritual energy for which he is unready and which he cannot use. Again, it may attract to the aspirant a thought form of one of the great ones, and thus swing him deeper into the world of illusion and of astralism. Hence the need for humility, for a longing to serve and a resulting self-forgetfulness if one is to build truly and correctly. Such is the law. 2. A thought form can also act as a poisoning agent and poison all the springs of life. It may not be potent enough to swing out of its creator's aura, very few thought forms are, and find its goal in another aura, there to gather strength, and so return from whence it came. But it may have a vitality of its own, which can devastate the life of the aspirant. A violent dislike, a gnawing worry, a jealousy, a constant anxiety, and a longing for something or someone may act so potently as an irritant or poison that the entire life is spoilt and service is rendered futile. The entire life is embittered and devitalized by the embodied worry, hatred, or desire. All relationships with other people are rendered equally futile or even definitely harmful, for the worried or suspicious aspirant spoils the home circle or his group of friends by his inner poisonous attitude governed by an idea. His relation to his own soul and the strength of the contact with the world of spiritual ideas is at a standstill, for he cannot progress onward and is held back by the poison in his mental system. His vision becomes distorted, his nature corroded, and all his relationships impeded by the wearing, nagging thoughts which he has himself embodied in form and which have a life so powerful that they can poison him. He cannot rid himself of them, no matter how hard he tries or how clearly he sees, theoretically, the cause of his trouble. This is one of the commonest forms of difficulty, for it has its seat in the selfish personal life and is oft-times so fluidic that it seems to defy direct action. 3. The third danger against which the aspirant must guard himself is becoming obsessed by his own embodied ideas, be they temporarily right or basically wrong. Forget not that all right ideas are temporary in nature and must eventually take their place as partial rights and give place to the greater truth. The fact of the day is seen later as part of a greater fact. A man can have grasped some of the lesser principles of the ageless wisdom so clearly and be so convinced of their correctness that the bigger whole is forgotten and he builds a thought form about the partial truth which he has seen, which can prove a limitation and keep him a prisoner and hold him back from progress. He is so sure of his possession of truth that he can see the truth of no one else. He can be so convinced of the reality of his own embodied concept of what the truth may be that he forgets his own brain limitations and that the truth has come to him via his own soul and is consequently colored by his ray, being subsequently built into form by his personal separative mind. He lives but for that little truth. He can see no other. He forces his thought form on other people. He becomes the obsessed fanatic and so mentally unbalanced, even if the world regards him as sane. How shall a man guard himself from these dangers? How shall he rightly build? How shall he preserve that balance which will enable him to see truly, judge rightly, and so preserve his mental contact with his soul and with the souls of his fellow men? First and foremost, by the constant practice of harmlessness. This involves harmlessness in speech and also in thought, and consequently in action. It is a positive harmlessness involving constant activity and watchfulness. It is not a negative and fluidic tolerance. Secondly, by a daily guarding of the doors of thought and a supervision of the thought life. Certain lines of thought will not be permitted. Certain old thought habits will be offset by the institution of constructive creative thinking. Certain preconceived ideas, note the esoteric value of that phrase, will be relegated to the background so that the new horizons will be visioned and the new ideas can enter. This will entail a daily, hourly watchfulness, but only until ancient habits have been overcome and the new rhythm established. Then the aspirant will discover that the mind is so focused on the new spiritual ideas that the old thought forms will fail to arrest the attention. They will die of inanition. There is encouragement in this thought. The first 3 years' work will be the hardest. After that, the mind will be engrossed by the ideas and not by the thought form. Thirdly, by refusing to live in one's own thought world and by entering the world of ideas and the stream of human thought currents. The world of ideas is the world of the soul and of the higher mind. The stream of human thoughts and of opinions is that of the public consciousness and of the lower mind. The aspirant must function free in both worlds. Note this with care. The thought is not that he must function freely, which involves more the idea of facility, but that he must function as a free agent in both worlds. Through constant daily meditation, he does the first. Through wide reading and sympathetic interest and understanding, he accomplishes the second. Fourthly, he must learn to detach himself from his own thought creations and leave them free to accomplish the purpose for which he intelligently sent them forth. This fourth process falls into two parts. First, by the use of a mystic phrase, he severs the link which holds an embodied idea in his thought aura. Second, by detaching his mind from the idea, once he has sent it on its mission, he learns the lesson of the Bhagavad Gita and works without attachment. These two points will vary according to the growth and status of the aspirant. Each has for himself to formulate his own severing phrase, and each has for himself, alone and unaided, to learn to look away from the three worlds wherein he works in his effort to push his idea of the work to be done. He has to teach himself to withdraw his attention from the thought form he has built, wherein that idea is embodied, knowing that as he lives as a soul and as spiritual energy pours through him, so his thought form will express the spiritual idea and accomplish its work. It is held together by the life of the soul and not by personality desire. The tangible results are ever dependent upon the strength of the spiritual impulse animating his idea, which is embodied in his thought form. His work lies in the world of ideas and not in physical effects. Automatically, the physical aspects will respond to the spiritual impulse. Salvation from death. We come now to the second phase of our study of the final words of Rule 11. We have dealt with salvation from the dangers incident to the creation of thought forms by a human being who has learnt or is learning to create on the mental plane. Much could have been said from the standpoint of the inability of the majority of students to think with clarity. Clear thinking involves capacity to dissociate oneself, temporarily at least, from all reactions and activities of an emotional nature. As long as the astral body is in a state of restless movement and its moods and feelings, its desires and emotions are powerful enough to attract attention, positive pure thought processes are not possible. Until the time comes when there is a more general appreciation of the value of concentration and of meditation, and until the nature of the mind and its modifications are more universally understood, any further teaching on the subject would be futile. In these instructions, I have sought to give an indication of the first steps in esoteric psychology and have dealt primarily with the nature and mode of training of the astral body. Later on in this century, the psychology of the mind, its nature and modifications, may be handled in more detail, but the time is not yet. Our subject now is salvation from the body nature through the process of death. Two things must be borne in mind as we seek to study the means of this salvation. First, by the body nature, I mean the integrated personality, or the human equipment of physical body, vital or etheric vehicle, the matter or mode of being of the desire nature, and the mind stuff. These constitute the sheaths or outer forms of the incarnated soul. The consciousness aspect is sometimes focused in one and sometimes in another, or is identified with the form or with the soul. The average man works with facility and self-consciousness in the physical and astral bodies. The intelligent and highly evolved man has added to these two the conscious control of his mental apparatus, though only in certain of its aspects, such as the memorizing or analyzing faculties. He has also, in some cases, succeeded in unifying these three into a consciously functioning personality. The aspirant is beginning to understand something of the principle of life which is animating the personality, whilst the disciple is utilizing all three because he has coordinated or aligned the soul, the mind, and the brain, and is therefore beginning to work with his subjective apparatus or energy aspects. Secondly, this salvation is brought about through a right understanding of the mystical experience we call death. This is to be our theme, and the subject is so immense that I can only indicate certain lines along which the aspirant may think and posit certain premises which he can later elaborate. We shall confine ourselves also primarily to the death of the physical body. Let us first of all define this mysterious process to which all forms are subject, and which is frequently only the dreaded end, dreaded because it is not understood. The mind of man is so little developed that fear of the unknown, terror of the unfamiliar, and attachment to form have brought about a situation where one of the most beneficent occurrences in the life cycle of an incarnating Son of God is looked upon as something to be avoided and postponed for as long a time as possible. Death, if we could but realize it, is one of our most practiced activities. We have died many times and shall die again and again. Death is essentially a matter of consciousness. We are conscious one moment on the physical plane, and a moment later we have withdrawn onto another plane and are actively conscious there. Just as long as our consciousness is identified with the form aspect, death will hold for us its ancient terror. Just as soon as we know ourselves to be souls and find that we are capable of focusing our consciousness or sense of awareness in any form or on any plane at will, or in any direction within the form of God, we shall no longer know death. Death for the average man is a cataclysmic end involving the termination of all human relations, the cessation of all physical activity, the severing of all signs of love and of affection, and the passage, unwilling and protesting, into the unknown and the dreaded. It is analogous to leaving a lighted and a warmed room, friendly and familiar, where our loved ones are assembled, and going out into the cold and dark night, alone and terror-stricken, hoping for the best and sure of nothing. But people are apt to forget that every night, in the hours of sleep, we die to the physical plane and are alive and functioning elsewhere. They forget that they have already achieved facility in leaving the physical body. Because they cannot as yet bring back into the physical brain consciousness the recollection of that passing out and of the subsequent interval of active living, they fail to relate death and sleep. Death, after all, is only a longer interval in the life of physical plane functioning. One has only gone abroad for a longer period, but the process of daily sleep and the process of occasional dying are identical, with the one difference that in sleep the magnetic thread or current of energy along which the life force streams is preserved intact and constitutes the path of return to the body. In death, this life thread is broken or snapped. When this has happened, the conscious entity cannot return to the dense physical body, and that body, lacking the principle of coherence, then disintegrates. It should be remembered that the purpose and will of the soul, the spiritual determination to be and to do, utilizes the thread soul, the sutratma, the life current, as its means of expression in form. This life current differentiates into two currents or two threads when it reaches the body and is anchored, if I might so express it, in two locations in that body. This is symbolic of the differentiations of Atma, or spirit, into its two reflections, soul and body. The soul, or consciousness aspect, that which makes a human being a rational thinking entity, is anchored by one aspect of this thread soul to a seat in the brain, found in the region of the pineal gland. The other aspect of the life which animates every atom of the body and which constitutes the principle of coherence or of integration finds its way to the heart and is focused or anchored there. From these two points, the spiritual man seeks to control the mechanism. Thus, functioning on the physical plane becomes possible and objective existence becomes a temporary mode of expression. The soul, seated in the brain, makes man an intelligent, rational entity, self-conscious and self-directing. He is aware, in varying degree, of the world in which he lives, according to the point in evolution and the consequent development of the mechanism. That mechanism is triple in expression. There are, first of all, the nadis and the seven centers of force. Then the nervous system in its three divisions, cerebrospinal, sympathetic, and peripheral, and then there is the endocrine system, which might be regarded as the densest aspect or externalization of the other two. The soul, seated in the heart, is the life principle, the principle of self-determination, the central nucleus of positive energy by means of which all the atoms of the body are held in their right place and subordinated to the will to be of the soul. This principle of life utilizes the bloodstream as its mode of expression and as its controlling agency, and through the close relation of the endocrine system to the bloodstream, we have the two aspects of soul activity brought together in order to make man a living, conscious, functioning entity governed by the soul and expressing the purpose of the soul in all the activities of daily living. Death, therefore, is literally the withdrawal from the heart and from the head of these two streams of energy, producing consequently complete loss of consciousness and disintegration of the body. Death differs from sleep in that both streams of energy are withdrawn. In sleep, only the thread of energy which is anchored in the brain is withdrawn, and when this happens, the man becomes unconscious. By this, we mean that his consciousness or sense of awareness is focused elsewhere. His attention is no longer directed towards things tangible and physical, but is turned upon another world of being and becomes centered in another apparatus or mechanism. In death, both the threads are withdrawn or unified in the life thread. Vitality ceases to penetrate through the medium of the bloodstream, and the heart fails to function just as the brain fails to record, and thus silence settles down. The house is empty. Activity ceases except that amazing and immediate activity which is the prerogative of matter itself and which expresses itself in the process of decomposition. From certain aspects, therefore, that process indicates man's unity with everything that is material. It demonstrates that he is part of nature itself, and by nature we mean the body of the one life in whom we live and move and have our being. In those three words, living, moving, and being, we have the entire story. Being is awareness, self-consciousness, and self-expression, and of this man's head and brain are the exoteric symbols. Living is energy, desire in form, coherence and adhesion to an idea, and of this the heart and the blood are the exoteric symbols. Moving indicates the integration and response of the existing, aware, living entity into the universal activity, and of this the stomach, pancreas, and liver are the symbols. It is interesting, though incidental to our subject, to bear in mind that in cases of imbecility and idiocy, and in that stage of old age which we call senile decay, the thread which is anchored in the brain is withdrawn, whilst that which conveys the life impulse or urge remains still anchored in the heart. There is life but no intelligent awareness. There is movement but no intelligent direction. In the case of senile decay, When there has been a high-grade apparatus utilized in life, there may be the appearance of intelligent functioning, but that is an illusion due to old habit and to old established rhythm, but not to coordinated coherent purpose. It must be noted also that death is, therefore, undertaken at the direction of the ego, no matter how unaware a human being may be of that direction. The process works automatically with the majority, for when the soul withdraws its attention, the inevitable reaction on the physical plane is death, either by the abstraction of the dual threads of life and reason energy, or by the abstraction of the thread of energy which is qualified by mentality, leaving the life stream still functioning through the heart, but no intelligent awareness. The soul is engaged elsewhere and occupied on its own plane with its own affairs. In the case of highly developed human beings, we often find a sense of prevision as to the death period. This is incident upon egoic contact and awareness of the wishes of the ego. It involves sometimes a knowledge of the very day of death, coupled to a preservation of self-determination up to the final moment of withdrawal. In the case of initiates, there is much more than this. There is an intelligent understanding of the laws of abstraction, and this enables the one who is making the transition to withdraw consciously and in full waking awareness out of the physical body and so to function on the astral plane. This involves a preservation of continuity of consciousness so that no hiatus occurs between the sense of awareness on the physical plane and that of the after-death state. The man knows himself to be as he was before, though without an apparatus whereby he can contact the physical plane. He remains aware of the states of feeling and of the thoughts of those he loves, though he cannot perceive or contact the dense physical vehicle. He can communicate with them on the astral plane or telepathically through the mind if they and he are en rapport. But communication that involves the use of the five physical senses of perception lies necessarily out of his reach. It is useful to remember, however, that astrally and mentally, the interplay can be closer and more sensitive than ever before, for he is freed of the handicap of the physical body. Two things, however, militate against this interplay. One is the grief and violent emotional upset of those left behind, and, in the case of the average human being, the other is the man's own ignorance and bewilderment as he stands faced by what are to him new conditions, though they are really old conditions, if he could but realize it. Once men have lost the fear of death, and have established an understanding of the after-death world, which is not based on hallucination and hysteria or on the conclusions, oft unintelligent, of the average medium who speaks under the control of his own thought form, built by himself and the circle of sitters, we shall have the process of death properly controlled. The condition of those left behind will be carefully handled so that there is no loss of relationship and no false expenditure of energy. There is a big difference now between the scientific method of bringing people into incarnation and the perfectly blind and oft frightened and surely ignorant way in which we usher them out of incarnation. I seek today to open the door in the Occident to a newer and more scientific method of handling the process of dying, and let me make myself perfectly clear. What I have to say in no way abrogates modern medical science with its palliatives and skill. All I plead for is a sane approach to death. All I seek to make is a suggestion that when pain has worn itself out and weakness has supervened, the dying person be permitted to prepare himself, even if apparently unconscious, for the great transition. Forget not that it takes strength and a strong hold on the nervous apparatus to produce pain. Is it impossible to conceive of a time when the act of dying will be a triumphant finale of life? Is it impossible to vision the time when the hours spent on the deathbed may be but a glorious prelude to a conscious exit? When the fact that the man is to discard the handicap of the physical sheath may be for him and those around him the long-waited-for and joyous consummation? Can you not visualize the time when instead of tears and fear and the refusal to recognize the inevitable, the dying person and his friends would mutually agree on the hour and that nothing but happiness would characterize the passing? that in the minds of those left behind the thought of sorrow will not enter, and deathbeds will be regarded as happier occasions than births and marriages? I tell you that before so very long this will be deeply so for the intelligent of the race, and little by little for all. You say there are as yet only beliefs as to immortality, and no sure evidences. In the accumulation of testimony, in the inner assurances of the human heart, in the fact of belief in eternal persistence as an idea in the minds of men, lies sure indication. But indication will give place to conviction and knowledge before another 100 years has elapsed, for an event will take place and a revelation be given to the race which will turn hope into certainty and belief into knowledge. In the meantime, let a new attitude to death be cultivated and a new science of death be inaugurated. Let it cease to be the one thing we cannot control and which inevitably defeats us, and let us begin to control our passing over to the other side and to understand somewhat the technique of transition. Before I take up this subject in greater detail, I would like to make reference to the web in the brain, which is intact for the majority, but is non-existent for the illumined seer. In the human body, as you know, we have an underlying, interpenetrating, vital body, which is the counterpart of the physical, which is larger than the physical, and which we call the etheric body, or double. It is an energy body and is composed of force centers and nadis, or force threads. These underlie, or are the counterparts of the nervous apparatus, the nerves and the nerve ganglia. In two places in the human vital body, there are orifices of exit for the life force. One opening is in the solar plexus, and the other is in the brain at the top of the head. Protecting both is a closely woven web of etheric matter composed of interlacing strands of life energy. During the process of death, the pressure of the life energy beating against the web produces eventually a puncturing or opening. Out of this, the life force pours as the potency of the abstracting influence of the soul increases. In the case of animals, of infants, and of men and women who are polarized entirely in the physical and astral bodies, the door of exit is the solar plexus, and it is that web which is punctured, thus permitting the passing out. In the case of mental types, of the more highly evolved human units, it is the web at the top of the head in the region of the fontanelle which is ruptured, thus again permitting the exit of the thinking, rational being. In psychics, and in the case of mediums and lower seers, clairvoyant and clairaudient people, the solar plexus web is permanently ruptured early in life, and easily, therefore, they pass in or out of the body, going into trance, as it is called, and functioning on the astral plane. But for these types, there is no continuity of consciousness, and there seems no relation between their physical plane existence and the happenings which they relate whilst in trance, and of which they usually remain totally unaware in the waking consciousness. The whole performance is below the diaphragm and is related primarily to animal sentient life. In the case of conscious clairvoyance, and in the work of the higher psychics and seers, there is no trance, obsession, or mediumship. It is the web in the brain which is punctured, and the opening in that region permits the inflow of light, information, and inspiration. It confers also the power to pass into the state of samadhi, which is the spiritual correspondence to the trance condition of the animal nature. In the process of death, these are, therefore, the two main exits, the solar plexus for the astrally polarized, physically biased human being, and therefore of the vast majority, and the head center for the mentally polarized and spiritually oriented human being. This is the first and most important fact to remember, and it will easily be seen how the trend of a life tendency and the focus of the life attention determine the mode of exit at death. It can be seen also that an effort to control the astral life and the emotional nature, and to orient oneself to the mental world and to spiritual things, has a momentous effect upon the phenomenal aspects of the death process. If the student is thinking clearly, it will be apparent to him that one exit concerns the spiritual and highly evolved man, whilst the other concerns the low-grade human being who has scarcely advanced beyond the animal stage. What then of the average man? A third exit is now in temporary use. Just below the apex of the heart, another etheric web is found covering an orifice of exit. We have therefore the following situation. 1. The exit in the head used by the intellectual type by the disciples and initiates of the world. 2. The exit in the heart used by the kindly, well-meaning man or woman who is a good citizen, an intelligent friend, and a philanthropic worker. 3. The exit in the region of the solar plexus used by the emotional, unintelligent, unthinking man and by those whose animal nature is strong. This is the first point in the new information which will slowly become common knowledge in the West during the next century. Much of it is already known by thinkers in the East and is in the nature of a first step towards a rational understanding of the death process. The second point to be grasped is that there can be a technique of dying and a training given during life which will lead up to the utilization of that technique. As regards the training to which a man can submit himself, I will give a few hints which will be found to convey a new meaning to much work now being done by all aspirants. The elder brothers of the race who have guided humanity through long centuries are now busy preparing people for the next great step to be taken. This step will bring in a continuity of consciousness which will do away with all fear of death and link the physical and astral planes in such a close relation that they will in reality constitute one plane. Just as an at-one-ment has to be brought about between the various aspects of man, so a similar unification has to take place in connection with the various aspects of the planetary life. The planes have to be at-oned, as well as soul and body. This has already been largely accomplished between the etheric plane and the dense physical plane. Now it is being rapidly carried forward between the physical and the astral. In the work being done by seekers in all departments of human thought and life, this unification is proceeding, and in the training now suggested to earnest and sincere aspirants, there are other objectives than just the one of producing soul and body at one-ment. No emphasis, however, is laid upon them, owing to the ability of man unduly to emphasize the wrong objectives. It might well be asked if it is possible to give a simple set of rules that could be followed now by all who seek to establish such a rhythm that life itself is not only organized and constructive, but when the moment for vacating the outer sheath arrives, there will be no problem nor difficulty. I will therefore give you four simple rules that link up with much that all students are now doing. 1. Learn to keep focused in the head through visualization and meditation and through the steady practice of concentration. Develop the capacity to live increasingly as the king seated on the throne between the eyebrows. This is a rule that can be applied to the everyday affairs of life. 2. Learn to render heart service and not an emotional insistence on activity directed towards handling the affairs of others. This involves, prior to all such activity, the answering of two questions. Am I rendering this service to an individual as an individual, or am I rendering it as a member of a group to a group? Is my motive an egoic impulse, or am I prompted by emotion, ambition to shine, and love of being loved or admired? These two activities will result in the focusing of the life energies above the diaphragm and so negate the attractive power of the solar plexus. Hence, that center will become increasingly inactive and there will not be so much danger of puncturing the web in that locality. 3. Learn, as you go to sleep, to withdraw the consciousness to the head. This should be practiced as a definite exercise as one falls to sleep. One should not permit oneself to drift off to sleep, but should endeavor to preserve the consciousness intact until there is a conscious passing out onto the astral plane. Relaxation, close attention, and a steady drawing upwards to the center in the head should be attempted, for until the aspirant has learned to be steadily aware of all processes in going to sleep and to preserve at the same time his positivity, there is danger in this work. The first steps must be taken with intelligence and followed for many years until facility in the work of abstraction is achieved. 4. Record and watch all phenomena connected with the withdrawing process, whether followed in the meditation work or in going to sleep. It will be found, for instance, that many people wake with an almost painful start, just as they have dropped asleep. This is due to the slipping out of the consciousness through a web which is not adequately clear, and through an orifice which is partially closed. Others may hear an intensely loud snap in the region of the head. This is caused by the vital airs in the head, of which we are not usually aware, and is produced by an inner aural sensitivity which causes awareness of sounds always present but not usually registered. Others will see light as they fall asleep, or clouds of color, or banners and streamers of violet, all of which are etheric phenomena. These phenomena, which are of no real moment, are all related to the vital body, to pranic emanations, and to the web of light. The carrying on of this practice and the following of these 4 rules over a period of years will do much to facilitate the technique of the deathbed, for the man who has learned to handle his body as he falls asleep has an advantage over the man who never pays any attention to the process. In relation to the technique of dying, it is only possible for me at this time to make 1 or 2 suggestions. I deal not here with the attitude of the attendant watchers. I deal only with those points which will make for an easier passing over of the transient soul. First, let there be silence in the chamber. This is, of course, frequently the case. It must be remembered that the dying person may usually be unconscious. This unconsciousness is apparent, but not real. In 900 cases out of 1,000, the brain awareness is there, with a full consciousness of happenings, but there is a complete paralysis of the will to express and complete inability to generate the energy which will indicate aliveness. When silence and understanding rule the sick room, the departing soul can hold possession of its instrument with clarity until the last minute and can make due preparation. Later, when more anent color is known, only orange lights will be permitted in the sick room of a dying person, and these will only be installed with due ceremony when there is assuredly no possibility of recovery. Orange aids the focusing in the head, just as red stimulates the solar plexus, and green has a definite effect upon the heart and life streams. Certain types of music will be used when more in connection with sound is understood, but there is no music as yet which will facilitate the work of the soul in abstracting itself from the body, though certain notes on the organ will be found effective. At the exact moment of death, if a person's own note is sounded, it will coordinate the 2 streams of energy and eventually rupture the life thread. But the knowledge of this is too dangerous to transmit yet and can only later be given. I would indicate the future and the lines along which future occult study will run. It will be found also that pressure on certain nerve centers and on certain arteries will facilitate the work. This science of dying is held in custody, as many students know, in Tibet. Pressure on the jugular vein and on certain big nerves in the region of the head and on a particular spot in the medulla oblongata will be found helpful and effective. A definite science of death will inevitably later be elaborated, but only when the fact of the soul is recognized and its relation to the body has been scientifically demonstrated. Mantric phrases will also be employed and definitely built into the consciousness of the dying person by those around him, or employed deliberately and mentally by himself. The Christ demonstrated their use when he cried aloud, "Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit." And we have another instance in the words, "Lord, now lettest thou thy servant depart in peace." The steady use of the sacred word chanted in an undertone or on a particular key, to which the dying man will be found to respond, may later constitute also a part of the ritual of transition, accompanied by the anointing with oil, as preserved in the Catholic Church. Extreme unction has an occult scientific basis. The top of the head of the dying man should also symbolically point towards the east, and the feet and the hands should be crossed. Sandalwood only should be burned in the room, and no incense of any other kind permitted, for sandalwood is the incense of the first or destroyer ray, and the soul is in process of destroying its habitation. This is all I can at this time communicate on the subject of death for the consideration of the general public, but I conjure all of you to push the study of death and its technique as far as possible and to carry forward occult investigation of this matter. Rule 12. The web pulsates. It contracts and expands. Let the magician seize the midway point and thus release those prisoners of the planet whose note is right and justly tuned to that which must be made. Interludes and cycles. The prisoners of the planet. Rule 12. Interludes and cycles. We now come to the four rules which concern the physical plane. In many ways, their understanding is far more difficult than was the case in the other rules, in just the same way that practical application is far harder than theorizing. We can frequently think with clarity and desire rightly, but the working out into physical plane manifestation of the subjective ideas, under law and constructively, is never an easy thing to do. It is, however, just at this point that a white magician begins to do his real work, and it is just here that he encounters failure and finds that his inner grasp of reality does not necessarily result in correct creative activity. In A Treatise on Cosmic Fire, there will be found certain points of interest for us to consider, and I would like to quote a few words from them. Quote, "It might be useful here to remember that in the work of creation, the white magician avails himself of the current ray influences. When the fifth, third, and seventh rays are in power, either coming in at full meridian or passing out, the work is much easier than when the second, sixth, or fourth are dominant. At the present time, the seventh ray, as we know, is rapidly dominating, and it is one of the easiest of the forces with which man has to work. Under this ray, it will be possible to build a new structure for the rapidly decaying civilization and to erect the new temple desired for the religious impulse. Under its influence, the work of the numerous unconscious magicians will be much facilitated." Close quote. Pages 1021 to 1022. It is apparent, therefore, that the day of opportunity is with us and that the coming generation can, if it so wishes, perform the magical work with many of the factors present which will tend to produce satisfactory results. The fifth ray is passing out, but its influence can still be felt. The third ray is at full meridian, and the seventh ray is rapidly coming into right activity. Much will consequently occur to make man successful, provided he can preserve constantly a right orientation, purity of motive and of life, a stabilized and receptive emotional body, and that inner alignment which will make his personality a true vehicle for his soul or self. A very interesting analogy works out as we study the words, "The web pulsates, it contracts and expands." The underlying thought is that of pulsation, of diastole and systole, of ebb and flow, of cyclic activity, of the day of opportunity and the night of inactivity, of inflow and output, and of those many appearances and disappearances which mark the sweep of all lives in all kingdoms and dimensions. This day and night cycle, which is the inevitable mark of manifested existence, has to be recognized. One of the things which every disciple has to learn, putting the truth in the simplest terms, is to achieve that wisdom which is based on a knowledge of when to work and when to refrain, and on an understanding of those periods or interludes which are characterized by speech and by silence. It is here that mistakes are made, and here that many workers fail to make good. This entire rule might be given in the following paraphrase, which will merit careful thought, and which I will elucidate somewhat. God breathes, and his pulsating life emanates from the divine heart and manifests as the vital energy of all forms. It flows, pulsating in its cycles, throughout all nature. This constitutes the divine inhalation and exhalation. Between this breathing out and the breathing in comes a period of silence and the moment for effective work. If disciples can learn to utilize these interludes, they can then release the prisoners of the planet, which is the objective of all magical work performed during this world period. With the manner in which this one life of the solar system works in these vast interludes of meditative silence, called technically a pralaya, we need not concern ourselves. The activity of the universal mind and its comprehensive purpose can only be perceived when each son of God enters consciously into his divine heritage. The mode of working by means of which our planetary life utilizes the cycles of silence concerns him alone, and it must be remembered that each planetary logos has a different pulsation, a varying periodic interlude, and his own unique method of procedure. What does concern the student of these instructions, however, is how he can himself attain a definite constructive activity in his interludes. These interludes, for the purpose of our discussion, fall into three categories. 1. Life interludes, or those periods wherein the spiritual man is out of incarnation and has withdrawn into the egoic consciousness. These, for the little evolved, are practically non-existent. They cycle in and out of incarnation with amazing rapidity. The physical plane analogy of this rapidity of activity is to be found in the intense rushing to and fro of the ordinary man as he meets the exigencies of existence, and also in the difficulty he evidences in patience and in waiting and in achieving the meditative poise. As growth takes place, the periods of withdrawal from incarnation steadily lengthen until the point is reached when the periods out of physical manifestation greatly exceed those spent in outer expression. Then the interlude dominates. The periods of outgoing, exhalation, and of inbreathing, inhalation, are relatively brief, and, the point to be emphasized, these two periods are colored and controlled by the purposes of the soul, formulated and recorded on the mind during the interlude between the two more active stages of experience. The inner life, slowly developed during the cyclic interludes, becomes the dominating factor. The man gradually becomes subjective in his attitude, and the physical plane expression is primarily then the result of the inner thought life, and not so much the result of reaction to physical plane occurrences and the restlessness of the desire nature. 2. The ebb and flow of daily life during a particular incarnation will also demonstrate its interludes, and these the aspirant has to learn to recognize and to utilize. He has to register the distinction between intense outgoing activity, periods of withdrawal, and interludes wherein the outer life seems static and free from active interest. This he must do if he is to avail himself fully of the opportunity which life experience is intended to furnish. The whole of life is not concentrated in one furious, continuous stretch of rushing forth to work, nor is it comprehended in one eternal siesta. It has normally its own rhythmic beat and vibration, and its own peculiar pulsation. Some lives change their rhythm and mode of activity every 7 years. Others alter every 9 or 11 years. Still others work under shorter cycles and have months of strenuous endeavor followed by months of apparent non-effort. Some people, again, are so sensitively organized that, in the midst of work, events and circumstances are so staged that they are forced into a temporary retirement wherein they assimilate the lessons learned during the preceding period of work. Two groups of human beings work with apparently no physical plane ebb and flow, but manifest steadily an urge to work. These are people who are so little evolved and so low down, if one might thus express it, on the ladder of evolution, and so predominantly animal that there is no mental reaction to circumstances, but simply a response to the call of physical needs and the use of time for the satisfaction of desire. This never lets up, and therefore there is little that can be called cyclic in their expression. They include the unthinking toiler and the uncivilized man. Then there are those men and women who are on the opposite scale and have climbed relatively high on the ladder of progress. These are so emancipated from the purely physical and are so aware of the nature of desire that they have learned to preserve a continuous activity based on discipline and service. They work consciously with cycles and understand somewhat their nature. They know the divine art of abstracting their consciousness into that of the soul in contemplation, and can control and wisely guide their work in the world of men. This is the lesson which all disciples are learning, and this is the high achievement of the initiates and trained workers of the race. 3. The third type of interlude, and the one with which we are here primarily concerned, as we consider the magical work on the physical plane, is the interlude achieved and utilized during the meditation process. With this, the student must familiarize himself, for otherwise he will be unable to work with power. This interlude, or period of intense silence, differentiates itself into two parts. There is, first of all, the interlude which we call contemplation. I would remind you of the definition given in a book by Evelyn Underhill, which describes contemplation as an interlude between two activities. This period of silence succeeds upon the activity, found so difficult by the beginner, of making the alignment between soul, mind, brain, of quieting the emotional body, and of achieving that concentration and meditation which will serve to focus and reorient the mind upon a new world and place it within the sphere of influence of the soul. It is analogous to the period of inhalation. In this cycle, the outgoing consciousness is gathered in and lifted up. When success crowns this effort, the consciousness then slips out of what we call the personality, the mechanism aspect, and becomes a changed consciousness. The soul on its own plane becomes active, and of this activity the mind and brain are aware. From the standpoint of personality activity, an interlude takes place. There is a point of inspired waiting. The mechanism is entirely quiescent. The mind is held steady in the light, and the soul, in the meantime, thinks, as is its habit, in unison with all souls, taps the resources of the universal mind, and formulates its purposes in line with the universal plan. This cycle of recorded soul activity is followed by what might be called the process of exhalation. The interlude comes to an end. The waiting mind again becomes active, and insofar as it has been rightly oriented and held in a purely receptive attitude, it becomes the interpreter and instrument of the soul, which has now turned the light of its countenance upon the attentive personality. Through that medium, it can now work out the plans formulated in the interlude of contemplation. The emotional nature is swept by desire to make objective the plans with which the reoriented mind seeks to color its experience, and subsequently the brain receives the transmitted impression, and the physical plane life is then adjusted so that those plans can properly materialize. This, of course, delineates a mechanism, trained and adjusted and rightly responsive, a rare thing indeed to find. The second part of the interlude only becomes possible when the first or contemplative interlude has been achieved. The disciple who is seeking to cooperate with the hierarchy of masters and to manifest this cooperation by active participation in their work on the physical plane has to learn to work not only through the contemplative realization, but through a scientific utilization of the interludes developed in breathing between points of inhalation and exhalation in the purely physical sense of the term. This is the true science and objective of pranayama. The brain consciousness is necessarily involved. The interlude between breaths is only capable of right use when a man has achieved the power to follow the interlude of contemplation affecting the soul and the mind and the brain. Just as the mind has been held in the light and has been receptive to the soul impression, so the brain has to be held receptive to impression from the mind. One interlude, therefore, from the standpoint of the unified soul and personality, takes place after the period of soul inhalation, when the outgoing consciousness has been gathered inward, and the other takes place at the close of that interlude, when the soul again becomes outgoing consciously to the objective world. Exhalation takes the place of inhalation and also has its interlude. The disciple has to learn facility in utilizing these two soul interludes, one of which produces effects upon the mind and the other upon the brain. There is, as always, a physical plane analogy of this process of divine inhalation and exhalation with its two interludes of silence and of thought. let me again reiterate the consequences of these interludes. In the higher interlude, abstract or divine thought impresses the soul and is transmitted to the waiting mind. In the other, the mind, through concrete thought and an attempt to embody divine thought in form, impresses the brain and produces action through the medium of the physical body. Students of occultism who have demonstrated their devotion and their mental poise, and who, to use the ancient formula of the schools of meditation, have kept the five commandments and the five rules, and have achieved right poise, can begin to use the interludes between the two aspects of physical breathing for intense activity and the use of the power of will to produce magical effects.